said, "You should be aware that I've already spoken to Mr. Hammernut and LaBelle. He described Mr. O'Toole as a former employee, not a friend. Said he hardly remembered him." Chaz sat back and crossed his arms. "Fine. We'll play it your way." Like I've got a choice, he thought. Glossy with perspiration, Toole lumbered into the kitchen to check on the entree. "3 more minutes," he announced, and walked out. "He's staying here with you?" Rolvag asked. "Yeah, while his double wide gets fumigated." "What's with the highway crosses?" "I'm not sure," Chaz Perrone said, "but it might have something to do with him being a deranged, half-witted sociopath." "Right. He claims to be carrying a bullet slug in the crack of his butt." "Everybody's got problems," Rolvag said. "Is there, like, a particular reason you're here?" Chaz inquired. "Besides the sheer sadistic joy you obviously get from busting my balls?" "Yes, of course," said the detective. "Then can we get to it, please? I've got a 3-hour drive to the middle of nowhere, thanks to you." Rolvag reached for his briefcase, but then Toole reappeared, briskly toweling his sweaty torso. With uncharacteristic buoyancy, he asked if anybody was hungry.
"The Kazaka need a bus," he said,
forking crispy hunks of alligator tail from the frying pan onto a platter. Apparently Rolvag will be staying for supper, Chaz thought, and I'm helpless to stop it. He hoped that Toole had efficiently disposed of the illegal reptile carcass. "I hope you like chicken," Chaz said to the detective. Toole let out a cackle.
"We're talking major chicken. Serious fucking swamp chicken."
"Smells delicious," Rolvag said, "but no thanks. I've got a lasagna waiting at home." "And my stomach is acting up again," Chaz chimed in, with barely masked relief. Gnawing on the deep-fried ass of a prehistoric lizard was not his notion of a gourmet experience. In fact, only imminent starvation could have induced him to consume anything from the sullied waters of Hammernut Farms.
"Then I'll eat the whole fucker myself," Toole said eagerly.
So barbaric was the gustatory spectacle that Chaz Perrone and Carl Rolvag retreated to the living room, the detective pausing to admire the restocked aquarium. "Those little blue-striped fellows, are they wrasses?"
"Your guess is as good as mine," Chaz thinking. "Do I look like friggin' Jacques Cousteau?"
"You were about to ask me something," he said, "before we got interrupted by Chef Cro-Magnon." Rolvag sat on the sofa and opened the briefcase. Leafing through a file folder, he said, "Yes, I need a sample of your wife's handwriting."
"What the hell for?"
Chaz knew it wasn't a well-measured response, but the detective's request had flustered him. "For comparison purposes," Rolvag said. Chaz rolled his eyes and snorted, an unfortunate reflex whenever he felt confronted by authority. It had caused him problems in college as well.
"I don't need much," Rolvag said. "A few lines in pen or pencil."
Chaz stood up and said he'd see what he could find, which of course would be nothing. He had thrown away everything Joey had ever written to him, birthday cards, love letters, post-its. The detective hovered while Chaz pretended to search. "I put away most of her stuff," he said, pawing through a bureau drawer in the bedroom.
"I remember."
"Where are those boxes?" Rolvag asked.
"Storage," Chaz thinking, "under about 5,000 tons of raw garbage."
"Even just a signature would be fine," Rolvag said.
"Hang on, I'm still looking."
"What about her checkbook?" Chaz shook his head and dug into another drawer. He didn't know where the detective was headed with the handwriting angle, but it couldn't be good.
"Credit card receipts?" Rolvag said.
"God only knows where she put them."
"How about cooking recipes? Some people jot their favorite ones on index cards."
Joey was a fantastic girl, but not exactly queen of the kitchen. Chaz trying to sound fondly reminiscent. "We ate out a lot. he added with a forced chuckle. Rolvag suggested searching Joey's car. Maybe there's an old grocery list crumpled on the floor somewhere.
Good idea, said Chaz, knowing full well the futility of that exercise.
Rolvag poked around the garage while Chaz picked through the Camry, which smelled faintly of his wife's killer perfume. Fearing another untimely erectile episode, Chaz breathed through his mouth in order to minimize his exposure. Eventually, he heard Rolvag saying, "Well, thanks for taking a look." The cop was a damn good actor, Chaz had to admit. Not once had he slipped out of character. Chaz had been waiting for some subtle acknowledgement of the situation, a sidelong wink, the wry flicker of an eye. Yet Rolvag had betrayed no awareness of the blackmail scheme while sustaining his front as a dogged and upright pursuer of clues. A less perceptive criminal might have discarded the theory that Rolvag was the one shaking him down, but Chaz Perrone wasn't swayed by the detective's performance. The more Chaz thought about it, the more unlikely it seemed that anybody had seen him push Joey off the Sun Duchess. Chaz remembered how careful he'd been to wait for the decks to empty first. He remembered standing alone at the rail afterward and hearing nothing but the rumble of the ship's engines. No voices, no footsteps. The blackmailer had to be bluffing. Nobody could have witnessed the murder of Joey Perrone. And now Carl Rolvag, who'd plainly never believed Chaz's account of that night, had decided in the absence of evidence to make him pay for the crime in another way. As they returned to the living room, Chaz coyly asked, "Who's your favorite movie star?"
"Let me think," Rolvag pressed his lips together.
"Frances McDormand."
"Who?"
"She was in Fargo."
"No, I meant guy movie stars," Chaz said.
"I don't know. Jack Nicholson, I guess."
"Not me. Charlton Heston is my favorite."
Chaz watched for the slightest flush of color in the detective's face. Rolvag was saying, "Yes, he's good, too. Ben-Hur was a classic." And that was it. Not a blink of surprise, not a hint of a smile. Chaz Perrone was so aggravated that he couldn't stop himself from saying, "Anyone ever tell you that sometimes you sound like him?" The detective seemed amused.
"Like Charlton Heston? Me?
No, that's a new one."
What an iceberg, thought Chaz.
He said, "Sorry I couldn't help with Joey's handwriting. I can't believe there wasn't something of hers lying around the house."
"No sweat. I'll call the bank," Rolvag said. "They'll have all her canceled checks on film."
"Can I ask what this is about?"
"Sure."
The detective removed a large envelope from his briefcase and handed it to Chaz Perrone, who couldn't stop his fingers from trembling as he opened it. He skimmed the first paragraph and asked,
"Where'd you get this?"
"Keep going," Rolvag advised, and strolled off to the kitchen. By the time Chaz finished, his heart was hammering, his shirt was damp, and his skull was ringing like a pinball machine. Before him lay a photocopy of an astounding document, the last will and testament of Joey Christina Perrone. For Chaz, it was the ultimate good news, bad news joke. The good news, your dead wife left you $13 million. The bad news, the cop who thinks you murdered her finally found a motive. Chaz placed the papers on his lap and dried his palms on the sofa. He flipped again to the last page and eyed the signature.
"Is it hers?"
Rolvag standing at the doorway, popping another goddamn sprite.
"I swear I didn't know anything about this," Chaz said. "And you can put me on a polygraph."
"Check out the date it was signed. Only a month ago," Rolvag said.
"Joey never said one word to me about this."
"That's interesting.
Don't you think I would have told you about it if I'd known? For Christ's sakes, I'm not an idiot!"
Chaz could feel his gears slipping.
"Is this the real deal, or is it just part of the setup? And don't act like you don't know what I'm talking about."
The detective said, "I couldn't tell whether it's authentic or not. That's why I'm here, Chaz.
That's why I wanted a sample of Mrs. Perrone's handwriting.
You listen to me! No more games, Chaz bellowed. No more bullshit, okay? You're a fucking crook, and I know exactly what you're up to. This isn't Joey's will, it's a goddamn fake. You couldn't find a way to prosecute me, so now you're going to frame me, then make me buy my way out.
Here Chaz contemplated ripping the will into pieces for dramatic effect. However, in the back of his mind, a tiny voice reminded him of the slim but sobering possibility that he was mistaken about Rolvag, that the shocking legal instrument was legitimate. Chaz found himself inadvertently clutching it with both hands, the way Moses, at least as portrayed by Chuck Heston, clung to the holy tablets of the law. Maddeningly immune to insult, Rolvag said, "You can keep it, Chaz. I've got copies." Tool entered the room, his cheeks shiny with gator dribble. He asked what all the hollering was about. "Mr. Perrone got a little upset with me," the detective explained, "but he's calmed down now." Chaz said, "Not much." Tool said,
"Doc, you look like shit on a dumpling."
"Thanks for noticing. Can the detective and I have some privacy?" When the two of them were alone again, Rolvag said, "I asked you about the signature." "It looks sort of like Joey's." "Close enough, anyway," Chaz said. "Whoever you got to forge it did a good job." Rolvag's expression remained unchanged. "Let me be sure I understand. You're accusing me of fabricating this will for the purpose of implicating you in your wife's disappearance?"
"Duh."
"But you mentioned blackmail. I don't get it."
"Try the dictionary." Chaz thinking, "The fucker wants to see me squirm? Forget it."
Rolvag thought for a moment, then said, "So the plan would be that you pay me off, and I'll make your $13 million motive go away. Mrs. Perrone's will vanishes."
"Exactly. And don't forget your bogus eyewitness."
"What?" The detective cocked his head slightly, as if listening for the faint call of a rare songbird. It was a reaction so nuanced as to be chillingly convincing.
"What eyewitness?" he asked.
Chaz felt his stomach turn.
Holy Jesus. Either this guy is really slick, or I've just made the worst mistake of my life.
"What eyewitness?" Rolvag said again. Chaz laughed thinly.
"I'm kidding, man."
It was a conversation for which he had not rehearsed.
"It didn't sound like you were kidding."
"Well, I was," Chaz said.
"You Scandinavians, I swear."
Rolvag quietly closed the briefcase. "I'm not blackmailing you, Mr. Perrone."
"Of course you're not."
"But you should still be careful," the detective said, rising. "More careful than you've been so far." 18. Joey struggled with the list of blackmail demands, but all she truly wanted from Chaz Perrone were, besides his eternal suffering, the answers to two questions. A. Why did you marry me? B. Why did you try to kill me?
"Pick a number," said Mick Stranahan. "This is supposed to be a shakedown, remember? How much dough can he scrape together?"
"Beats me." Joey turned to stare out the window. Flamingo was a fish camp in Everglades National Park, on the southernmost shore of mainland Florida. Only one road led there, a two-lane blacktop that sliced through 38 miles of unbroken scrub, cypress heads, and sawgrass prairies. Although they were speeding through absolute darkness, Joey sensed a pulse of unseen life all around them. The post-Miami hush was so soothing, the night so engulfing, she was unable to focus on the details of the blackmail. The deeper they drove into the Everglades, the smaller and more absurd Chaz Perrone seemed. Stranahan parked the Suburban in a cluster of cabbage palms near the campground, a short jog from the marina.
By now it was 10 o'clock, and most of the campers, besieged by insects, had retreated to their sleeping bags. Mick fiddled with the dashboard stereo, but the radio signal was spotty. Joey said she'd never before been to the park. Chaz refused to take me. He said it reminded him too much of work. Actually, I think the bugs creep him out. The bugs. Mosquitoes especially, she said. Then there's the snake issue. He's terrified of being bitten by a moccasin. At home, he used to practice injecting the anti-venin serum into grapefruits. Boy, is he in the wrong line of work, Stranahan remarked. You ever wonder why? How the hell he got where he is? Joey had always assumed that her husband made a wrong turn in graduate school. I meant to ask you, Stranahan said. Who's Samuel J. Hemmernut? Some rich redneck pal of Chaz's. I met him at the wedding, said Joey. Why? What's he got to do with all this? I made a few calls about the Hummer. It was bought for your hubby by Hemmernut Farms. Joey had no idea why Mr. Hemmernut would have given Chaz a brand new SUV. You're just now telling me this? Who did you call? Friends who do that sort of thing. Trace paperwork. Friends in law enforcement, Stranahan said. Remember I told you this was all about greed. My guess is that Chaz has some sort of dirty arrangement with Hemmernut, and that maybe you got in the way. But how? What did I do? Stranahan told his theory to Joey, who was intrigued but skeptical. Who ever heard of a crooked biologist? She asked. Who ever heard of one with a bodyguard? He countered. Joey conceded the point. She had been surprised and tickled to learn from Mick that her husband was now being protected by paid muscle. Look, there are cops who take payoffs, Stranahan was saying. Judges who fix cases, doctors who cheat Medicare. Are you telling me Chaz is too pure to sell himself? The man who pushed you into the ocean to die? He's right, Joey thought. Obviously the jerk is capable of anything. She scooted closer and put a hand on Mick's knee. He kissed her on the top of the head, but she could tell he was tense. He pointed toward the motel building and said, "Your room's on the second floor. Stay put until you see me signal with the flashlight. 3 blinks, I remember." They watched a pair of raccoons shuffle into the campground, emerging moments later with a loaf of bread and a bag of Doritos. Stranahan said, "Isn't the idea to make him panic?" "Yeah. Tighten the screws." "And what the hell? Let's ask for 500,000. Joey laughed. "Good Lord! Chaz doesn't have that kind of money." "I bet he knows someone who does." They took the Grand Marquis, Tool saying that the Hummer practically glowed in the dark. Red had told them to stay cool no matter what. "Listen to what the guy has to say and tell him you'll think about it. Don't be a smartass," Red had warned Chaz. "And don't hurt nobody," he said to Tool. "Not just yet. Once we find out what the sumbitch wants, then we'll figure out what to do about him." The plan was to arrive at Flamingo early and find a spot for Tool to hide. But they got delayed because Tool made another pit stop before they hit the turnpike. Chaz didn't bother to ask. He stayed in the car and practiced whipping the .38 out of his waistband, while Tool put on his tent-sized lab whites and marched into the Elysian Manor convalescent home. Maureen was sitting up watching television. She had brushed her hair and put a touch of makeup on her cheeks. "Well, look who's here," she said. "Pull up a chair. Larry King is interviewing Julie Andrews. What a doll she is."
"I brung you some supper."
Tool placed a covered dish on the bed tray.
"It ain't very hot. Have they got a microwave somewheres?"
"Why, thank you, Earl."
Maureen lifted the lid and said,
"It smells grand. What is it?"
Chicken. Swamp chicken, they call it.
"Doctor says I'm supposed to steer clear of fried foods, but I can't honestly see the harm. Since I'm dying anyway, right?"
She picked up a piece of fried alligator and popped it into her mouth.
"Good, huh?" Tool said.
Maureen nodded eagerly as she chewed. And chewed.
"The food they serve us here is a horror," she whispered. "Fresh poultry is a real treat."
"Well, I'm glad you like it. Now I'll better go."
"Already? Please sit and visit."
"I got a portin' business meeting."
"At night? What kind of business, if I might ask?"
"Bodyguardin'," Toole said.
Maureen's blue eyes sparkled.
"That's so interesting, Earl. What sorts of people do you guard? Dignitaries? Diplomats? Show business types, I bet."
"Not hardly."
"Oh,"
she sounded disappointed.
"The job I'm on now, he's a doctor," Toole said,
though he considered the title a hype job, as attached to Chaz Perrone.
"A doctor? Well, that's something."
"Only he don't work on people. He's like some kind of scientist,"
Maureen said.
"He must be very important to need personal protection."
"Don't get me started."
"Is he with you now? I'd enjoy meeting him."
Toole said,
"He ain't no charmer, trust me. Thinks the world of hisself, but I swear, the niggers and spicks used to pick tomatoes for me had more common sense than—"
Maureen's bony fist shot out and nailed Toole in the soft declivity below the sternum. He bent double and heard himself deflate like a tractor tire.
"Earl, shame on you," she said. "Don't you ever use that kind of hateful language around me."
He hung onto the bed rail, slowly straightening himself.
"What would your mother do," Maureen went on, "if she were alive to hear you talk like that?"
"She's the one I learned it from," he wheezed. "Her and my daddy both."
"Then shame on them, too. Here,"
she handed him a Dixie cup from the bed tray.
"Drink up. You'll feel better."
"Damn,"
Toole said, gulping at the water.
Crazy old witch had really thumped him. In his whole life, he couldn't remember anybody ever throwing a punch at him and getting clean away with it. Once he damn near crippled a couple of sorry beaners just for looking at him funny-like in the package store.
Staring now at Maureen, as frail and brittle as a fallen leaf, Toole knew he could have killed her with the back of his hand. Strangely, though, he didn't want to, and it wasn't as if he was holding back the urge. He just plain had no desire to harm the woman, despite what she'd done. He wasn't pissed, either, which was even more confusing. What he felt, and he wasn't sure why, was sorry. He heard himself say so. Maureen reached out and plucked at his sleeve.
"And I'm sorry, too, Earl, for striking you. It wasn't very Christian of me," she said. "How are you fixed for medicine?"
"Fine, ma'am. The patches you give me this morning ought to last for the weekend."
"You know, my husband was a Chicago police officer."
"You told me. Yes'm."
"One time he used the word nigger. I heard him let it slip," Maureen said. "He was on the phone to his sergeant or somebody. He said, some nigger robbed a Korean grocery and we chased him into Lake Michigan. When he hung up, I tapped him on the shoulder. He was a big fella, too. And I said, 'Patrick, if I ever hear you use that hateful word again, I'm taking the kids and moving back to Indianapolis to live with Aunt Sharon.' And you know what?"
"He never done it again,"
she smiled.
"That's right, Earl. Do you believe God made each of us in his own image?"
Toole said,
"I ain't always so sure."
He crossed his arms across his belly in case she took another swipe at him.
"To be honest, some days I wonder myself," Maureen said. "They've got one nurse here, Earl. I swear she's on loan from the depths of hell. Talk about the B word. But here's what I believe. Can I tell you? Then you're free to be on your way."
"Sure,"
Toole said.
"I believe it's never too late to change. I'm 81 years old, but I still think I can be a better person tomorrow than I am today. And that's what I'll believe until I run out of tomorrows, she said. Oh, one more thing. You promised to go see a surgeon.
Yeah, I know.
About the bullet in your you-know-what?
I've been real busy,
Tool said.
Young man, you listen here. Life's too darn short to be dragging around that kind of personal burden.
Yes'm.
Now get a move on before you miss your meeting, she said. And be careful tonight.
Don't worry.
Whatever it is you're up to.
Maureen flashing him a sideways glance.
Go on now, Earl.
She flicked a papery hand toward the door and returned her attention to the television. They got all the way to Florida City before Tool spoke, which was fine with Chaz Perone. He wasn't thinking about the blackmail meeting. He was fantasizing about what it would be like to have $13 million in the stupefying event that the will bearing Joey's name turned out to be authentic. The irony would be epic, for she wouldn't have left Chaz a nickel if she suspected him of forging the Everglades data.
Since it was dated only weeks ago, the will could be legitimate only if Joey hadn't figured out Chaz's deal with Red. Meaning he had murdered her for no reason. Or at least the wrong reason.
Contemplating the possibility made him lightheaded and queasy. Unless otherwise convinced, he'd stick to the more plausible hypothesis that Carl Rolvag had fabricated the document to intimidate him.
I'm hungry,
Tool grumbled, wheeling sharply into the parking lot of a Miami Subs shop. Bring me a Coke and some fries, said Chaz.
Get it yourself.
Chaz hid the .38 under the front seat and followed Tool into the restaurant. Chaz had begged and pestered for a new bodyguard, but Red Hammernut had refused, saying Tool was rock solid. Rock-headed is more like it, Chaz thought. They sat in a booth, Tool wolfishly attacking a turkey sub the size of a football.
Where's the gun?
Tool spraying half-mulched lettuce. Chaz pointed at the car through the window.
Ever shot anybody?
Tool asked. No.
Ever shot anything?
Birds, Chaz said.
As a kid, he'd used a BB rifle to snipe at the sparrows and warblers that woke him in the mornings.
Tool said,
You got no business with a gun unless you practice. I've been shot by a joker once already, and that's plenty.
Stop worrying. At the entrance of Everglades National Park, a ranger inquired about their lack of fishing gear and camping equipment. A notice taped to the kiosk warned against bringing firearms inside the park. We're meeting some friends, Chaz said. The Thornbergs. They're in a brand new Airstream, Michigan plates. Got an Irish setter named Mickey that rides up front. Did they come through here yet?
Couldn't say. I just came on duty.
Well, I'm sure we'll find them, Chaz waving pleasantly. A mile down the road, Tool spoke up.
Where the fuck did you come up with that one?
Pretty good, huh?
What's an Airstream?
Chaz said, A motorhome. You know, like a Winnebago, only not so clunky. He sure went for it, didn't he?
And that bullshit about the dog. You just all of a sudden thought that up?
Yep. Chaz couldn't tell if Tool was impressed or disgusted.
I've never seen nobody could lie in such a way.
Hey, sometimes you gotta think fast, Chaz said. That ranger, see, it's none of his business if we've got fishing poles or whatever in the car. But I can't come out and say that to his face, so I cook up a story and off we go.
Tool nodded, both hands on the wheel.
Pretty damn smooth, he said.
The sky was clouded and starless. Ahead of them, speared by the twin beams of the headlights, was a canvas of blackness. At first Chaz thought they were riding through a rain shower, but the splattering sound turned out to be a hail of bugs hitting the windshield. When a marsh rabbit appeared on the center stripe, Tool casually swerved to miss it. Chaz told him to stop the car right away.
Why? You gonna take a piss?
Tool coasted the sedan off the pavement and braked. "Turn us around," Chaz said.
"What for?"
"Hurry." Tool made a flawless three-pointer and headed slowly back up the road until they came to the rabbit, which hadn't moved. Chaz reached beneath the seat and took out the pistol. Tool blinked at him slowly, like a drugged toad. Chaz said, "You told me to practice, right?"
"Not on a fucking bunny."
"It's just an overgrown rodent," said Chaz, betraying an ignorance of taxonomy that would have appalled his colleagues, but was lost on Tool. "A rat with big ears," he added, stealthily opening the car door. Tool said,
"You shoot that thing, you're gonna eat it for breakfast."
"Yeah, right.
Doc, I ain't kidding. My mama used to tell us, anything that dies fries. Ain't right to waste a critter just for sport."
Chaz wondered if the medicine patches were making Tool loopy. Why should he care about a dumb rabbit? Chaz leaned across the hood of the car and took aim at the animal, which remained motionless in the lights. When the .38 went off, the rabbit hopped straight in the air, spun around once, dashed in a circle, and then stopped. Its eyes were wide, and its nose was quivering. "Shit, I missed," Chaz muttered, and fired again. This time the animal flattened itself to the pavement and laid back its ears, as if hiding in the scrub. Tool said,
"That's enough, Rambo."
"Just one more," Chaz thinking. "It's okay for him to plug an alligator."
"You're done," Tool said gruffly.
"Not quite," Chaz shutting one eye and squinting down the barrel.
"I said no!"
Tool goosed the accelerator a millisecond before Chaz squeezed the trigger. He felt himself vaulted airborne, and, suspended in flight, he witnessed the tawny blur of the rabbit disappearing into the tall grass. He came down hard in the loose gravel and rolled twice. For several moments he lay still, dazedly watching the insects swarm around the headlights of the idling car. Soon he heard the crunch of footfalls and saw the broad silhouette of Tool above him.
"Help me up,"
Chaz said, with an imprudent lack of remorse.
"You're one dumb fuck of a so-called doctor."
Tool picked up the .38 and stalked back toward the Grand Marquis.
"What the hell's wrong with you?" Chaz hollered after him. "Were you trying to kill me?"
He struggled to his feet and brushed the pebbles off his clothes. When he got back into the car, Tool jabbed a finger in his chest and said,
"If I was trying to kill you, pretty boy, you'd be having this conversation with St. Peter."
Chaz waited another 10 miles before asking about the gun. Tool said,
"You're done for the night."
"But what if I need it later? What if this asshole blackmailer decides to play rough?" Tool seemed to think that was quite funny.
"Boy, you won't need a gun," he said. "You got me."
19. Stranahan was already on the water when the Grand Marquis rolled up at the marina. The caveman got out slowly while Chaz Perrone practically ejected himself from the passenger side, slapping frenetically at his face and neck. They walked back and forth along the slips, eventually choosing an unoccupied houseboat and prying the door. The caveman ducked inside while Chaz hopped back on the dock, stumbling over a coiled rope. After a while, he began to pace in and out of the shadows, still flailing at the bugs. At midnight, Stranahan called out his name, and Chaz dropped into a ludicrous semi-crouch that he must have picked up from a Jackie Chan movie. Stranahan waved. "Over here, numbnuts." Chaz approached tentatively, continuing to affect the coiled pose of a kung fu master. He seemed alarmed to see his blackmailer sitting in a small canoe. "Hop in," Stranahan said as he nosed up to the boat ramp.
"No way! This was your idea, Chazzy."
"The meeting, not the place," Chaz said. "And not the damn canoe." Stranahan laid the paddle across his lap and gave Chaz some time to size him up. Then he said, "If you want to hear the deal, park your ass in the bow." Chaz glanced uneasily toward the slip where the houseboat was moored. Stranahan said, "That's another thing. I told you to leave your pal with Dr. Leakey."
"What are you talking about?
You're such a dolt. I should triple my price." Chaz stepped gingerly into the canoe.
"Where do I sit?"
"You don't sit," Stranahan said. "You kneel." With long, even strokes, he began paddling down the Buttonwood Canal toward Whitewater Bay.
"Can I borrow the bug spray?"
Chaz anxiously pointed to a cutter's squirt bottle in the bottom of the canoe. Stranahan tossed it to him.
"Where are we going?"
Chaz, spritzing himself. "There's nothing to be afraid of, as long as you don't tip us over."
"Don't worry, I'm not moving a muscle."
Chaz put down the bottle and got a death grip on the sides of the canoe. "Moccasin Pass, that's where we're headed," Stranahan said. To his knowledge, there was no such place. However, the ominous name produced the desired effect.
"Holy shit," he heard Chaz Perone murmur.
"Supposedly it's got the biggest water moccasins in the Glades," Stranahan went on, drawing a defeated groan. In person, Joey's husband was pretty much what Stranahan had expected, soft and whiny under pressure.
"You've also got your crocodiles and sharks, mister,"
Stranahan said, switching momentarily to his Jerry Lewis voice,
"which is why I strongly recommend against flipping the canoe."
Chaz fell silent. When they reached Whitewater, Stranahan stopped paddling and instructed Chaz to turn around, which he did with the utmost care. When Stranahan aimed a flashlight in his face, he flinched and looked away. Stranahan said, "You're sulking, aren't you? You think I'm having fun at your expense." To taunt such a pissmire was almost unsporting, but it diverted Stranahan from a nagging but barbarous impulse to beat the man into hamburger hash. Perhaps the day for such uncivilized festivities would come, but for now he'd settle for the sight of Charles Perrone's ears turning black with mosquitoes. It had been Joey's fine idea to replace the insect repellent with tap water.
"How'd you get into my house?" Chaz asked.
"Trade secret."
"Are you the one who cut up that picture of my wife and put it under my pillow?"
"No, that would be the picture fairy."
"Who the fuck are you? What do you want from me?" Chaz whacking at both sides of his head.
"Money, for starters."
"There's more?"
Chaz hacked out a sour laugh. "Plus, I'd like you to answer a few simple questions. That's it."
"What questions? You're shaking me down over something I didn't even do."
"Fine, then don't pay me a penny," Stranahan said. "We'll let a jury decide, my word against yours. By the way, have you ever been to scenic Rayford, Florida, home of the Union Correctional Prison?" Chaz swore and slapped himself again on the head. "Nice shot." Stranahan turned off the flashlight. "I guess the only way to prove I'm not bullshitting is to tell you exactly what happened on the Sun Duchess. Listen carefully."
"I am," Chaz said with a grunt.
"It was a week ago tonight," Stranahan began. "You and your wife came on deck shortly before 11 and walked toward the stern. Nobody was outside because it was raining. Oh, I almost forgot. You were wearing a dark blue blazer and charcoal slacks. Mrs. Perrone had on a cream-colored skirt, white sandals, and, I believe, a gold watch on her wrist." Joey had also told Stranahan the color of her blouse, but he'd forgotten. He flicked on the flashlight and saw that Chaz looked drained and unsteady. "You want me to keep going?"
"Suit yourself," Chaz croaked.
"So the two of you were standing alongside the rail, Mrs. Perrone just staring out to sea, when you pulled a really clever move," Stranahan said. "You took something from your pocket and dropped it. A coin, a key, something that made a sharp noise. Then you pretended like you were bending down to pick it up. Remember?" From the bow of the canoe, nothing. but instead you grabbed your wife by the legs and flipped her overboard. It happened so fast she didn't have time to fight back. You still with me? When Stranahan zapped Joey's husband again with the flashlight, his eyes were wide and glassy. Stranahan had seen similar expressions in the studio of an amateur taxidermist. "You look like you're coming down with something," he said. "Did you ever get vaccinated against that icky Nile virus?" Chaz coughed violently. "There's a vaccine?" If it had been almost anyone else, Stranahan might have felt sorry for the wretched fool. "Why'd you do it, Chaz?"
"I didn't."
"You're calling me a liar? Ouch." Chaz said,
"Just tell me how much you want."
$500,000.
"Man, you're fucking crazy."
"Cash," the blackmailer said. "Hundreds are fine." A light breeze had sprung up from the southeast, nudging the small canoe farther into the vast black bay. The mild rocking motion that Stranahan found so calming seemed to have the opposite effect on Joey Perone's husband. He said,
"Where am I supposed to come up with $500,000?
"Hey, Chaz, I've got an idea," Stranahan thinking. "It's like shooting fish in a barrel. You could ask your pal, Hammernut." No flashlight was required to gauge Dr. Charles Perone's reaction. The raucous whoop of his vomiting incited a lusty reply from a male heron wading the shoreline a quarter of a mile away. Mick and Chaz had been gone only 20 minutes when Joey made up her mind to leave the motel room. She put on a baggy cotton jersey and tucked her hair under her Marlins cap and walked down to the docks. In the parking lot, she spotted a big black sedan that looked like the one parked in front of Chaz's house the night before. Leaning against the car was a tall, wide man wearing dark overalls over a fuzzy shirt. When Joey got closer, she saw that the shirt was actually a coat of dense body hair. The man spotted her and said,
"Come here, boy."
Joey positioned herself beneath one of the light stanchions in the hope he would see that she wasn't a threat. The man said,
"You there for what? I said to come here."
"You're the bodyguard, aren't you?" Joey asked. He swatted her with the back of his hand, and she went down. With a twist of her jersey, he yanked her up off the pavement and dropped her on the trunk of the sedan.
"You ain't no damn boy," he said. "You's a girl."
Joey fumbled to pull down her jersey, which had bunched up around her bra. She faintly tasted blood.
"Hey, don't get freaked. I'm here with a blackmailer."
"No shit?"
the man said curiously.
"He's my boyfriend."
The man seemed to want to think about that. Joey let him. Then he grabbed the back of her neck and said,
"I could kill you right now. Feed you to the goddamn gators, and by dawn there wouldn't be nothing left. Not even bones."
He was squeezing so hard that Joey feared she would pass out. The man was strong enough to pinch off her head with his fingers.
"And killing me," she said, "would accomplish what exactly?"
After a moment's contemplation, he let go.
"Yeah, it's your boyfriend is the problem."
Joey rubbed her neck.
"I'm not trying to tell you how to do your job, but if anything happens to him, the cops will be getting a package containing all kinds of interesting tidbits about your client."
"Client?"
"The guy you're guarding. Charles Perone," Joey said. "Can I ask your name?"
"They call me Tool."
"I'm Anastasia."
Ever since she was a little girl, she'd wanted to call herself that. It sounded so much more feminine and elegant than Joey. The man named Tool said,
"Your boyfriend. What's he want from the dock?"
Joey said she didn't know. "I'm just the lookout. He handles the business end." The man turned halfway and looked toward the boat ramp.
"Where's that canal go to?"
"Beats me. What you got stuck on your back?"
"Nothing."
Joey stepped forward and placed a hand on each arm.
She had never in her life seen so much hair on a human being. "You turn around," she said. "Come on, Mr. Toole." Pulling him into the pale circle of light, she noticed that irregular swaths had been crudely shaved across his shoulder blades. Several tan patches had been attached in no particular configuration.
"These medicine stickums," Toole explained.
"For what?"
"Killing pain."
"Uh-oh. You're sick?" Joey asked.
"I got me a bullet in a real bad spot."
A truck pulled into the parking lot. A cab pickup with blue police lights mounted on the cab.
"That's a park ranger," Joey whispered.
They watched the truck make a slow pass through the marina area. When it was gone, Toole said,
"Where's that damn canoe? This is taking way too long."
"Well, the two boys have lots to talk about."
Toole patted the front pockets of his overalls.
"Damn," he said. "My cell phone. Be right back."
He stomped down the docks and disappeared inside a dark houseboat. When he returned, he was swearing at the portable phone in his hand.
"I can't get no signal down here," he complained.
"Who are you calling?" Joey asked.
"None of your business."
"Who's paying you anyway?"
"Not Chaz Perrone, I know." Toole snatched the front of her jersey and yanked her face close to his.
"Stop with the goddamn questions, hear?"
His breath smelled oniony, and a sickly damp heat rose from his skin.
"I don't feel right," he said.
"Maybe it's the medicine. How about I grab you a Coke?"
"How about if you shut up?"
"Okie doke," Joey said.
Toole sat on the fender of the car, which sagged under his heft. For 10 minutes he poked angrily at the keypad of his cell phone, while Joey leaned against a piling and watched a school of electric blue baitfish race in and out of the shadows. She thought of the little canoe somewhere out in the darkness, and wondered if Mick was sticking to the script, or if he'd blown a fuse and done something unforgettable to her husband.
"Fuck it! I'll give up,"
Toole said at last, shoving the phone into his pocket.
"May I speak now?" Joey asked archly.
"Sing and dance, if you won't."
"You ever been married?"
"Yeah, common law," said Toole. 6 years. No, 7.
"What happened?"
"She went home to Valdosta for a funeral and never come back. I heard later she run off with the boy from the undertakers."
Joey said, "Did you know that Mr. Perrone pushed his wife off an ocean liner?"
"I figured it must be something like that."
"Could you imagine ever doing that to somebody?"
"All depends," Toole said. "I hurt my share of people, but never no women unless they lit after me first. Maybe she started it, his old lady. Maybe the guy was self-defending himself."
"Does he ever talk about her?"
"Not hardly. When I asked him, he said she was pretty and smart and all, but he didn't say what happened. Only that she's dead. The rest ain't none of my business."
"He didn't tell you why he did it?"
"You don't listen worth a damn, know that?"
Toole hoisted himself off the fender as if he were going to grab her again. She took a step backward. Pretty and smart and all. That's what Chaz was saying about her now that she was gone. "I wonder if he loved her," she said quietly. It made Toole laugh.
"You say love?"
"The whole thing bothers me. I can't help it."
Joey sensed that Toole was telling the truth about how little he knew.
"What I seen," he said, "a man loves himself more than anything on this earth. He's sure ain't one to cry and mope around and such."
"Wait until Chaz hears what Mick Stranahan has to say," Joey thought. "Then you'll see some moping," she said.
"You think he did it, too. I can tell you do."
"Makes no difference in my pay either way.
Your line of work, you can probably look once in somebody's eyes and know right off if they're lying. Mr. Perrone didn't fool you for a second, I bet."
Toole seemed immune to female flattery, a rare trait among men in Joey's experience. She tried a different approach.
How long have you been a bodyguard?
This here's my first crack at it.
No wonder you're jumpy, Joey said. Don't worry. Chaz will get back safe and sound, as long as he doesn't do anything stupid.
He's capable, said Tool. What I'm trying to figure out is how your boyfriend fits into the program. How it comes to, what you call it, mastermind the blackmail.
He was in the right place at the right time, that's all.
I see the same one broke into my man's house last night. 'Cause he's got some payback due if it is. Middle-aged guy, real tan. Looks sort of like him in the canoe, but I couldn't see so good from that houseboat. Damn windows all grimed up with salt.
He's the one, Joey said. Tool would find out anyway as soon as Mick returned with Chaz.
He's old enough to be your pa, ain't he?
Not hardly, she said defensively.
Well, he's a strong sumbitch, I'll give him that. He hurt me good.
Tool probed thoughtfully at his Adam's apple. He gets around all right for a geezer, Joey agreed. Say, what was your wife's name?
Jean. Janie Suzanne is what we called her.
You miss her? Joey asked.
Not no more. Time heals, is what they say.
Do you think Mr. Perrone misses his wife? Tool said.
You tell me. He took all her pictures down. Every picture in the house, gone.
But he told you she was pretty.
That's what he said. But she could have been a hog snapper for all I know. Tool shrugged. I don't get paid to figure this shit out.
Joey said, I've got to be going now. Thanks for the chat. Tool seemed disappointed.
You can't hang around for when they come back?
She shook her head. Better not. I've got my orders.
Me too,
Tool said with weary frustration. It was by far the worst night of Charles Perrone's life. You done? The blackmailer asked. Chaz wiped off his lips and spit hard over the side, trying to purge the pukey taste from his mouth. He had no clue how the man had found out about Red Hammernut. It was the second piece of disastrous news that Chaz received in the canoe, the first being that the blackmailer had in fact witnessed Joey's murder. You're surprised that I've done my homework, the man said. So was Rika.
He knows about Rika, too? Chaz thought miserably. What a nightmare.
He boxed at his head, trying to vanquish the unbearable chorus of mosquitoes. The damn thing seemed to have drilled through his eardrums into the meat of his brain. Other disturbing sounds rose from the darkness of the bay. Loud, violent splashes. Piercing cries of birds. This is hell, Chaz told himself. That's where I am. Your buddy Hammernut owns some serious farmland south of the big lake, the man said. I'm guessing you faked the water test to make it look clean. Saves him a fortune, too. How much is he paying you? Besides the new Hummer, I mean. Chaz turned away, anticipating another blast from the flashlight.
You don't know what you're talking about, he insisted hoarsely.
Oh, I know exactly what I'm talking about. So do you. Chaz couldn't make out the blackmailer's expression, but the white crescent of a smile was visible. And here's another bulletin for you, Chazzy boy. Carl Rolvog isn't in on this deal. I've never met the guy in my life, and you'd better pray that I don't. Chaz fought back a fresh impulse to gag. He lowered his head and waited for the sensation to pass.
What about the fake will?
He mumbled to his kneecaps. What will? The man said.
Oh, Jesus.
If you barf in this canoe, you're swimming home. Chaz said,
I'll be all right. Just give me a minute.
It dawned on him that he wouldn't even know which way to swim. The sky had cleared, but the glittering constellations offered no navigational guidance. Dr. Charles Perrone being as ignorant of astronomy as he was of the terrestrial sciences.
Whose will? The blackmailer asked again.
Your wife's? Never mind. So it was real, Chas thought. The document that Rolvag had shown him. $13 million with my name on it, and all I've got to do is avoid death row. Let's say I scrape up the money, he said. Yes, let's say. The blackmailer laughed. Bring it in a suitcase. Now for the questions. Oh, come on, Chas said. I've only got two. First, why did you marry her? Swell, thought Chas. I'm being shaken down by Montel Williams. Because I really liked her, he said impatiently. She was fun and good-looking and sharp. I thought I was ready to settle down. Without warning, the blackmailer clobbered him with the paddle, the flat side landing squarely on the crown of Chaz's head. He saw it coming, even in the dimness, an arcing downward blur. On impact, he let out a moan and pitched forward. The canoe rocked, but did not flip. All you wanted, the man said, was a hot girl on your arm, Chazzy. A girl your buddies would notice and talk about. The female equivalent of a new Rolex. You weren't getting married. You were accessorizing. Chas slowly pushed himself up from the bottom of the canoe and repositioned on his knees. He touched his scalp and felt a rising knot. Meanwhile, the blackmailer had resumed paddling as if nothing had happened. He looked tan and solidly built, but he was so much older that Chas had been completely surprised by the sudden blow. It was the sort of thing a young hothead might do. And the fact she was rich didn't hurt, did it? The man said. I never asked for a dime, Chas protested. Which leads to my second question. Why'd you throw her into the ocean? Chas swallowed in a way that sounded like a dying bullfrog. He had no intention of admitting the crime. I guess you want to spend the night out here, the blackmailer said. Alone. Anything happens to me, you don't get paid. The man's laughter made Chas shudder. Try to understand, Junior. It's not just the money. I'm pissed. But you didn't even know her. Funny, though, I feel like I do. Calmly, the man swung the paddle out of the water and batted Chas in the face. Not hard enough to knock him over, but hard enough to crimp his nose. God damn! Chas cried, a warm trickle running down his fingers. The blackmailer said, As you can tell, I'm taking this whole thing very personally. Tell me why you did it, and I'll row you back to the docks. I just can't. Chazzy, you know that I know exactly what happened. All I'm asking you is why. The guy had a point. He already knew everything, and Chaz wasn't keen on getting smacked again.
What if you're wearing a wire?
Chaz was pinching his nostrils, trying to staunch the bleeding. Now he sounded like a cartoon duck. Again, the blackmailer's grin gleamed in the starlight. You're priceless, he said, peeling off his T-shirt. Then he held the flashlight at arm's length and aimed it back toward his bare chest, which was quickly darkening with mosquitoes. See? No hidden microphones, he said to Chaz. Feel better now? I guess. Then answer the question, please. I thought Joey had busted me, Chaz heard himself say. I thought she'd figured out the water scam. And for that you heaved her overboard? In the middle of the fucking Gulf Stream? You don't understand, Chas said. If she ever blew the whistle on me and Mr. Hammernut, you can't possibly understand the implications. The thing is, I was out of options. If only she... What, Chas? If only she'd given me a reason not to do it, Chas thought. Like showing me the new will. Never mind, he said. The blackmailer began paddling with more purpose, and Chas marveled at how briskly they were gliding across the water. Being averse to exercise, he'd never been a fan of canoes. A ski boat powered by a 200-horse Mercury was Chas's idea of a dream ride. How's the schnoz? the blackmailer asked him. It hurts. Chaz's nose had swollen to the size of a bell pepper. Soon they came to the long canal through which they'd entered the bay, and Chaz was immensely relieved. The blackmailer was taking him back to Flamingo. Suddenly the man stopped rowing and leaned back. Chaz could see the shine of his sweat and hear the ravenous buzz of insects on his face and chest. "Want some bug spray?" Chaz asked. The man chuckled. "No thanks." He extended the paddle to Chaz and said, "Your turn, killer."
"What?"
"Yeah, I'm whipped." Chaz took the paddle and examined it, as if it were an intricately engineered device. "Please don't tell me you've never rowed a canoe," the blackmailer said.
"Of course I have."
Chaz tried to remember the last time, way back in grad school on some scummy lake in North Carolina. He and another student were helping a professor trace the dissolution of muskrat feces in bottom sediment. Chaz had ended the day with oozing blisters on the palms of both hands. He couldn't swing a golf club for a month. "Hurry up, Chazzy, we're drifting back to Whitewater."
"Sorry, but I'm not up for this. My head's killing me."
"You'll be fine."
"But I'm still bleeding, for God's sake."
"Did you ever see Deliverance?" the blackmailer said.
"Remember what happened to the chubby guy?"
Chaz Perone started battling. 20. Being labeled a crook was a new experience for Karl Rolvag, and it kept him awake much of the night. He was more intrigued than indignant, for it was impossible to feel insulted by someone like Charles Perone. The blackmail accusation was so boggling that the detective viewed it as a critical twist in the case, a clue no less important than the fingernails in that soggy bale of weed. Rolvag stood in his ritual cold shower for nearly 20 minutes, replaying in his head the odd conversation with Joey Perone's husband. He didn't doubt that the man was being extorted, but by whom? And with what sort of information? Perone had snidely referred to a bogus eyewitness, which raised in Rolvag's mind the tantalizing possibility of a real one. Yet such a scenario would require that the witness be nearly as venal and ice-blooded as Perone himself, someone capable of watching a woman murdered and not trying to stop it. Someone who, instead of rushing to the police, would go directly to the killer with a demand for hush money. Given the pestilential abundance of lowlifes in South Florida, it was surely possible that Perone's crime had been randomly observed by someone equally degenerate. Still, Rolvag thought it was more likely that the blackmailer wasn't a fellow cruise passenger, but rather some enterprising scammer who'd read about Joey Perone's disappearance in the newspapers. In any event, the detective was not displeased that the threat had driven Perone into such paranoid agitation that he'd accuse a police detective of masterminding the plot. Criminals in such a ragged state of mind often made reckless mistakes, and it was Rolvag's hope that the remorseless widower would continue on a path of self-sabotage. Most tantalizing was the link between Perone and Samuel Johnson Hammernut. Rolvag had found nothing to substantiate Perone's flimsy story that the $60,000 Humvee had been a gift from his wife, with Hammernut acting innocently as a middleman. Rolvag believed that the farm tycoon had intended the Hummer, and one could only imagine what else, as payola for Chaz. It had been Rolvag's observation that men like Red Hammernut were not spontaneously generous and usually demanded something valuable in return. What would a lazy, unscholarly biologist such as Perone have to offer? The detective had a hunch. Then there was the remarkable last will and testament of Joey Perone, which had excited even the laconic Captain Gallo. If the will proved to be bogus, the forger was most likely the blackmailer. What better way to turn up the heat on Perone than to chum up the cops with a $13 million motive for murder? However, if the will was genuine... The detective turned off the water and stood there, dripping and thinking. He wasn't sure if the damn thing was legit or not. One handwriting expert said the signature looked authentic. Another thought it was a fake. The trust officers in charge of Joey Perone's fortune had a signed will in their files, but they had balked at providing a copy in the absence of a death certificate. Whether or not the document delivered anonymously to Rolvag proved genuine, he intended to do everything in his power to prevent Mr. Perone from collecting a nickel from Mrs. Perone's estate. The surest way to accomplish that, in the detective's view, was to lock Mr. Perone away for the rest of his natural life. That mission had come to occupy Carl Rolvag so exclusively that he had temporarily postponed the chore of boxing his belongings for the move to Minnesota. He toweled off and pulled on a pair of jeans. On his way to the kitchen, he noticed that another sheet of paper had been slipped under his door, presumably by Mrs. Schulman or one of her operatives. The repeat intrusion was enough to make the detective consider a blocking measure, such as shag carpeting, but he'd be vacating the apartment soon enough. Rolvag picked up the paper. It was a flyer featuring a color photograph of a frail-looking, roomy-eyed dog. Lost, Pinchot, 11-year-old male Pomeranian, neutered. Cataracts, diverticulitis, gout. If found, please do not approach or attempt to handle. Please contact Bert or Addie Miller at Sawgrass Grove 9L. $250 reward. Rolvag was heartsick. Even though the condominium board had warned the Millers about letting their senescent pooch off the leash, the detective felt personally responsible for the fate of little Pinchot, hobbled, half-blind, and easy pickings for a prowling python. Rolvag resolved to spend the remainder of his Saturday searching the property for his escaped pets, one of which doubtlessly would be slowed by a telltale Pomeranian-sized lump. Of course, the Millers would be consoled and fully compensated. First, though, Rolvag had one bit of leftover police work. He picked through the loose scraps in his briefcase until he found the number for Corbett Wheeler in New Zealand. The detective was leaving a long message on the answer machine when Joey's brother picked up the phone and said, "Start over, please. I was dead asleep." Rolvag apologized and asked, "Did your sister have a will?" "Yes, but let me guess. A new one has surfaced." "It seems so, and it leaves everything to her husband." Corbett Wheeler laughed. "I told you he was a fuckwit, did I not? How can he possibly believe he's going to get away with this?"
"Here's the thing, Mr. Wheeler. I don't think Charles Perone is the one who forged the will, assuming it is forged.
Joey wouldn't leave that pus bucket enough money for bus fare to..."
A crackle of long-distance static obscured Corbett Wheeler's terse commentary.